Would one of you please describe impeachment, the process? What is it? How does it work?
Impeachment was laid out after a great discussion by the founders. The biggest debate, I think, was over whether the Senate would remove with a majority vote or a two-thirds vote. Basically, what happened, the process is there's two ways to initiate an impeachment. One is for a member of Congress to submit a bill of impeachment in the House, and it has to be a representative. And the other way is for what your state is doing and what you should all be going to the hearing for on the first is for a state legislature to pass a joint resolution to send a memorial to the House urging them to initiate an impeachment hearing so you can bypass the member bill. And I should say that this is occurring in New Mexico, Vermont, New Jersey, Washington, Oklahoma, Oregon, and possibly California. There's some talk in California, too. So it's sort of a race to see who gets to be there first. And you guys have a good shot.
All right.
And then what happens next is that the judiciary considers the matter, considers the bill, considers the memorial, and decides whether there's enough there to warrant them going to the full House to request that they be impaneled as an impeachment panel with subpoena power. Once they get to that point, they start hearings on the issues raised in the impeachment bill. And what's likely to happen is once you have one impeachment bill, the dam breaks and you'll have more impeachment bills. This is what happened with the Nixon case, where different people will pile on with other crimes that they'll raise. And so the House will have a whole bunch of issues to consider, the Judiciary Committee. And then the hearings are on, you start calling witnesses. It's great entertainment, by the way. That becomes like, you know, wall-to-wall C-SPAN or networks, because it's tremendously gripping drama having these witnesses talk. And the crimes are laid out unmediated by, you know, our complicit reporters. And people get to hear people say what the crimes are. And then the House Judiciary Committee impeachment panel decides they vote on these different bills and they come out as articles of impeachment. They got that far with Nixon and he resigned. And with Bill Clinton, of course, went beyond that. The House voted on the impeachment bills, and if the majority of the House supports an article of impeachment, which means a majority of one vote, then you have an impeachment. You have an impeached president. That's the impeachment. Now it moves from there to the Senate. And it doesn't have to go to the Senate. The Senate can decide at that point whether it wants to have a trial. And that's up to the Senate. If the Senate decides that there will be a trial, then the House becomes the prosecutors. It's usually the members of the Judiciary Committee that become the actual prosecutors. We saw this with the two cases of impeachment in our lifetimes. And nobody remembers Andrew Johnson's impeachment. And so you have to try it. And that has to be a two-thirds vote of the Senate in order to have a removal from office, which has never happened. And that's important because a lot of people say, oh, you know, you can never remove the president because he's never going to get a two-thirds vote in this Senate. Look at all the Republicans. You know? And that's probably true historically. Although this president is more of a criminal than the other presidents we've dealt with, so maybe he'll be removed. But even if he isn't, I think the important thing to remember is that what really sank Nixon was the hearings. And Benjamin Franklin, that wonderful slave owner from my home state, said one of his very great words of wisdom, and he had a lot, in the discussion over impeachment, when they were talking about whether to have a 50% majority or a two-thirds majority in the Senate to remove,
They ended up saying, well, you know, it really doesn't matter because I'm not quoting it verbatim. The Levin journalism, I don't know if the journalists love to come after you. He said, it really doesn't matter whether the removal issue, the important thing is the investigation. And he's right. He's been proven right. So. And there's no, this is not something that's subject to a court, by the way. You can't, once someone's impeached, there's no, they can't go to the court and have it overturned or anything. It's totally up to the Congress.
Does impeachment mean absolutely that there would be, that the president would be removed from office?
No.
I'm a sorting card. I apologize for that. Ms. De La Vega, this one's specifically for you. What would you say to my, not my, but somebody's 13-year-old niece who's here tonight regarding the relevance and importance of what all this holds to her in her life?
Oh, that's not a hard question. The relevance this holds to all of our lives, but particularly young people, I would say, is that we are in this time, I think, of a crisis. And we have a situation where we know that the administration has violated law after law after law, and we don't want to be the ones who are seen by future generations as people who just shrugged their shoulders and walked away. So certainly all of the civil liberties that we hold dear are ones that we want to be able to continue to hold dear. And if we have a president whom we allow to abrogate all those liberties now, who knows what's going to happen when this 13-year-old becomes an adult and we have a president who looks back and says, oh, look what they allowed President Bush to do.
There are several variations on a theme here, so I'll paraphrase. Can both the president and the vice president be impeached simultaneously?
You know, a lot of people ask that in a different way, so I might as well answer that too. They say, how can they impeach the president without Cheney as president? Or else they say, hopefully, well, we can get rid of both of them and we'll have Nancy Pelosi for president. But let me throw water on both of those. The political reality is that the last thing that the Republicans are going to want going into 2008 is Dick Cheney as the representative of the Republican Party. This is the most unpopular man in America. He's somewhere around 18%, and that's probably because 18% don't know him too well. I mean, the Republicans will get rid of him so fast you won't know what happened if it looks like Nixon, like Bush is going down. So, and there's lots of ways to get rid of him. You know, they can tell him to turn up or turn down the speed on his pacemaker, and say that he's got a heart problem, or they can indict him. I mean, this is probably the most indictable man in Washington, and I'm sure that much like Spiro Agnew, who was Nixon's Cheney, that there are files on Cheney in the FBI that are just sitting there waiting for someone to say, okay, show these to him and tell him, you know, to walk for, you know. So if it came to that, Cheney be gone. And what the Republicans would want at that point is a placeholder who would, you know, be acceptable to them and make it through a Senate confirmation. And that's how we ended up with Gerald Ford, you know, as president. So so look for another Gerald Ford to fill out the remaining term. And it would not be Nancy Pelosi for the obvious reason that I don't think the Democrats would want to, if they got to try to do impeachment, to be seen as simply replacing a Democratic president with a Republican president with a Democrat. So it'll be some placeholder.
Anybody else want to comment on that one? I'll take that as a no. Mr. McGovern, for you specifically, could you comment as to any complicity by the CIA with the constant slant and spin and disinformation relative to the issues that brought us here tonight?
Yeah, it's really easy to point to that. I point to George Tenet, first and foremost, the winner of the Presidential Order of Freedom, or whatever it is. This is a very sad tale, folks. The CIA I worked in, more often than not, had a director with integrity, had a director devoted to the ethos that we pursued, which was to speak truth to power and suffer the consequences. This fellow was quite a different breed. He was not really a professional intelligence officer. He was a politician. And that, my friends, is a kiss of death. When he was nominated, his big cachet was said to be, he's equally popular on both sides of the House. Now, everybody in Washington thought that was terrific, except intelligence officers who knew that that is a kiss of death for the head of the CIA, because if you're going to tell the truth, folks, you're going to be equally unpopular on both sides of the House, okay? So George Tenet, oozing charm from every pore, the backslapping Greek from Queens, got along fine with the president because he did what the president wanted and what the vice president wanted. He abnegated his responsibility to the ethos of the agency. He did what they said. When the Congress was asked to authorize the war in the fall of 2002, Bob Graham, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said, well, you know, is there a national intelligence estimate about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? I haven't really seen any intelligence on that. He was sort of asleep at the switch. So Bob Durbin said, well, let's ask George Tenet. And they asked him, and he said, well, no, there isn't any. You know why there wasn't any, folks? Because an honest one would have said, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. We know that 90% of those things were destroyed in 1991. We can't account for the other 10%, but that doesn't mean they're there. Despite Rumsfeld's theory that the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, more faith-based intelligence, folks. Okay? That's what an honest estimate would have said, okay? But a thoroughly dishonest estimate was prepared by direct order of the Vice President and George Tenet. And the very worst estimate said that Iraq had all manner of weapons of mass destruction. It even had the makings of a nuclear program. You know, I'll tell you a little story about the State Department. You know, the State Department, who was supposed to be supporting Colin Powell, but he wouldn't let it. State Department comes out very, very well in this little scenario, because they didn't see any evidence of a nuclear weapons development program. They poured all kinds of cold water over these centrifuge-related aluminum tubes. And actually, when they were asked around the table, this is the way the estimates go. You have 16 people around the table, say, okay, energy, what do you say about how soon Saddam Hussein could get a nuclear weapon? What do you say to the CIA? And state, what do you say? And the State Department representative, to his great credit, said, well, you ask a very embarrassing question, because, you know, it's really hard for us. We don't see any nuclear program having been restarted, and you're asking us to predict the fruition of a nuclear program that we don't see as having. You know, it's really hard. It reminds me of a cartoon that my history major daughter at the University of Virginia sent me. And it was a BC fellow with a, you know, loincloth and all, and he's obviously the paterfamilias, and he's standing on this rock. And his daughter is cringing before him, and he's reading this tablet, which is obviously a report card. And the caption says, oh, great. History F. You flunked something that didn't even happen yet. Well, that's what the State Department was being asked to do. Predict the end of something that didn't even happen yet, okay? And to their great credit, they took a lengthy footnote and said in diplomatic terms, this was cockamamie stuff, as they said about the report about Africa and uranium and all that stuff. So the State Department was distinguished by being the only intelligence outfit that had the guts to stand up to this pressure. And my friends, guess who Colin Powell forgot to bring with him up to CIA headquarters when he was preparing a speech for the UN? The State Department intelligence experts. This was a dishonest performance from stem to stern, folks. State Department folks were telling Colin Powell what the real situation was, and he chose to salute the president and prepare what he now regrets. And what really boils me is, you know, he expressed regret for his performance at the UN. Why? Because it's a blot on his career. Now, how about the 650,000 Iraqis who would be allowed to be allowed to? How about the 3,100 U.S. service people? How about the 25,000 wounded? And how about people like Aaron Latata, who've been marginalized by this corrupt administration?
To process and timeline. So if impeachment proceedings are begun, how long would it take?
There's no way to really know. I mean, I made the point that we could impeach him in a flash on the NSA spying because he simply broke the law and there's no need for hearings. You know, it could be done in a vote. Some of the other things require longer hearings because you need to take witnesses and develop evidence. The plain thing could take a long time. But my point, and I think this is really important, is it doesn't matter how long it takes. This is one committee. Congress is big. It has a lot of things. A lot of important legislation was passed while Nixon was being impeached. So it's a dodge for members of Congress to say, do you want to pass important legislation? And the other thing is, it doesn't matter if the clock's run out, because the important thing is that this guy's got to be impeached before he leaves office, and if it's the last day that he's in office, he should still be impeached, because that's the only way to prevent his crimes from being replicated by the president's findings in the future.
Just a little footnote here. There are people who say, well, wait till he starts a war on Iran. Then we got him. Then we got him. Then he can really impeach him. Well, I think, folks, we got to do it before he starts. The second carrier task force group arrived in the Persian Gulf 5 days ago. Last two times, there were carrier task force, two of them in the Persian Gulf. We struck out and attacked Iraq. Now, the danger is there, folks. And if you're talking to your representatives and your senators, get them off their duffs now and have them start now. It's good that, good to get it going. Now, it may take a while, but the very process of impeachment might be a disincentive to the Republicans and to the president.
There's one other point that comes up out of this, and that is that, the members of Congress, and Nancy Pelosi being the foremost of these, who claim that impeachment's off the table primarily because they say we want to pass our democratic progressive agenda. You know, how are they going to pass that agenda? Because, first of all, there's just the fact, simple fact that they only have a few votes extra to pass them, so they can't pass they can't get past a veto on any of this stuff. The second thing is, what about those signing statements? No legislation that this Democratic Congress passes is worth the paper it's written on if the president can continue to issue signing statements. And you can't pass a bill that says you can't do signing statements because it'll do a signing statement. So the only way to stop the signing statements and make legislation stick is to impeach it. So...
I love it when the panelists answer the questions before they're asked. But on that note, there are several questions about how or why the Congress has demurred from approaching the process of impeachment. And you just mentioned part of it. Anybody else want to comment about that?
I think one reason that Congress has demurred from the process of impeachment has to do with the Clinton impeachment. And what we have is actually the worst of all possible worlds, because the Clinton impeachment was an abuse of the impeachment process. It was not... One thing we haven't really talked about, but an impeachable offense doesn't have to be a crime. And the fact that something is a crime doesn't mean it's impeachable. It has to be something that goes to the abuse of power in the sense that it goes to governance of the country. But the perjury of President Clinton, I can tell you, having worked at the U.S. Attorney's Office for all these years, would probably never have been charged as a crime even, because it involved a situation involving private parties, and there's actually a part in the U.S. Attorney's Manual that addresses that very point. You look to the nature of what the perjury is about to decide whether to charge it. So it probably would have been charged as a crime, but more than that, it had nothing to do with governing the country. So that was an abuse of the process. But then what we have now is a kind of a double whammy effect, which is that it has really deterred the Democrats, I think, from bringing up the prospect of impeachment when it really is warranted. And that is just wrong. They are using their own political agenda, the Democrats, I mean, to avoid doing something which they really are obligated to do at this point. We know we have grounds for impeachment, and it's their obligation to move forward. But I think that is really one of the biggest reasons, the specter of the Clinton impeachment.
Well, that was the next question.
So on that theme, talking about the Congress's reluctance to move this way, can you comment about what you think specifically Congress is afraid of? And there are several here. Why has Representative Conyers moved away from his position on impeachment? What is the Democratic Party waiting for? Keep going.
I think that what's happened here is that the, I won't use carrots and spinos, bite my tongue. But what's happened is that, some of this complicated politics, Clinton, whatever you may think of him, introduced the concept, and his political advisors introduced the concept of mini politics, where you don't really legislate big issues. You try to get these little tiny meaningless issues that are easy to pass and don't change much, don't threaten anybody, and you get to call yourself a Democrat. And the main thing is a classic example of this. So everybody agrees it's a good thing, so you pass it, and then you get to say I'm a Democrat. But the result of that is that we have a bunch of politicians now who are afraid of big issues. They're afraid of controversy. But I want to point out that every single member of Congress took an oath of office, just like the President. And the oath of office says that they will uphold and defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. And guess what? We have a huge enemy of the Constitution in office, who's even referred to as that enemy of the Constitution. And so they have this obligation. I think that the other thing is that there's a lot of calculating going on. They think that somehow they may lose in 08 if they get involved in the impeachment process. And David Swanson, you can read his stuff on academicstreet.org, has written some well-researched stuff on the prior impeachments, including ones that didn't go anywhere, like the Republicans trying to impeach Sununu Bill's impeachment for Truman, and other cases where impeachment bills were submitted. And every single time, the party that pushed for impeachment gained after doing it. And that includes the Republicans with Clinton, their fraudulent impeachment. So there really is nothing to fear, aside from, and in addition to that, it's the right thing to do.
Okay, changing directions just a little bit. We've had a lovely discussion, but how corporate media to cover the discussion with the respectability it deserves.
Trust me, if Washington passes a resolution calling for impeachment, it's going to make front page.
For at least a day.
And then you'll have more states pass it, and it'll make a front page again and again, and it'll become the story of the hour.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
Okay. Why should Washington legislatures be involved in the impeachment since it's a federal process?
A couple of reasons. One is that is it pronounced only? Sunday pronounced? Representative only?
Omega?
Senator Omega? Senator, sorry. Made the very important point that the budget allotments that are going to this war could just as well be going to the states, including the state of Washington, and there are many things, not just individually for this state, but things that would apply to all states, such as education, health care, all kinds of important things that are being shorted because we are spending all this money on the war and our defense budget. But also, it's a state issue because I think this is a way to get people's attention, and it's a way to get your voice heard. When I first heard about these local and state resolutions, I admit I thought it was maybe a frivolous thing to do, but I completely have changed my mind. I think that it is extraordinarily important to do because if the state of Washington files such a resolution, people will pay attention. And then you have the state of Vermont, and then you have the state of New Mexico, and you have all these fine states around the country following suit because it emboldens other states as well. And it's just when one person stands up in a crowd, then another person stands up in the crowd and joins them, and it's the same process with the states.
Another point on that, you know, Tom Udall, who's a congressman from New Mexico, has said that if the legislature in New Mexico passes a joint resolution on impeachment, he will feel obligated to deliver that to Congress as the will of his state. And I think that you all should remember that, and maybe now's the time to go to your members of Congress and say, hey, you know, if this passes in the state of Washington, are you going to deliver it? No, because that is the message to the people of the state. They don't want to have it now, but they know.
Okay, technical question. Probably Ms. De La Vega, this might be a good one for you. What is the definition of high crimes in this defense?
Well, actually, I alluded to it before. It means, I don't know that there's actually one definition anywhere. I don't think there really is, but it's defined as something that's an abuse of power that goes to the governments of the country, something that violates the separation of powers. And it has to be a serious, serious abuse. And it's not something that's just maladministration. It has to be something that has an intent to overuse the power. So the founding fathers specifically ruled out the idea that somebody could be impeached just for doing a bad job.
Actually, the high crime concept was perceived by the founders as being political crimes. And so they actually talked about things like lying to the American people.
Right.
Obviously, all Americans, politicians, have lied. It's kind of sui generis. The argument they made was when a lie has serious consequences for the country, that is a high crime. And my co-author, Barbara Olchansky, who did the research on this for the book, said that the best definition of the thing is that the high crimes were political crimes, and the most serious. And what they referred to as misdemeanors in their conception was what we consider felonies. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the breaking of a law what was a serious law and related to administration, like the FISA Act that the president's broken, it would be like a misdemeanor. The lying to the American people about the war would be a high crime. So those are the two. And then, of course, you have treason and you have bribery. We've got those on here, too. So.
Well, how would any of you respond to this question or to this comment? President Bush was given the legal authority to invade Iraq by congressional action.
He was tricked into it. The intelligence community was used and abused to serve up to Congress a meretricious argument that was deliberately false and gave Congress the impression that Saddam Hussein was a threat to the United States. Patently absurd. They did this in September of 2002, and the Congress and, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate are not blameless here. It was all carefully contrived because you know what was going to happen in November of 2002, right? There would be an election. And so Karl Rove insisted that this vote be held several weeks before the election so that Democrats would be under great pressure to avoid being put in the position they were put in before the Gulf War, where many Democrats voted against the war and learned to rue the day after that very successful war. So the pressure was extreme, and people like Mrs. Clinton and others couldn't stand up to it. There were very few that stood up to it. Jim McDermott stood up to it. There are some people that... in you know, the 45 years I've been watching things in Washington pretty closely, I've seen a lot of fraud and deceit. Never. And I've seen the Tonkin Gulf resolution as well, so it's not quite fair to say that this is the first time this has happened, but never have I seen such an orchestrated, long-planned effort to deceive the American people to achieve aims other than the ones that were produced. Weapons of mass destruction, ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. Those were canards. Those were cockamamie excuses. What they wanted was the oil. What they wanted was to make that place safer for the state of Israel. What they wanted was permanent military bases to put the U.S. in position to help dominate that part of the world. That's very clear now as it all comes out. And those were not the reasons it used, and I'd suggest that that's lying to the American people in a most serious way, a most consequential way.
This was not a declaration of war. Can anybody else recall for me a declaration of war that was made 5 months before the start of the war? This is not a declaration of war. The vote in Congress, in that October vote, was a conditional vote. And it was very clear, made very clear by the members of Congress who voted for it, and it was pledged by the president when he argued for the vote, that this was to encourage Saddam Hussein to adhere to the inspections, and that Bush promised to go and get approval from the UN before he would do an invasion. He didn't do it. There was no approval from the UN. So there was no justification from, and no approval from Congress for him to then go on and invade Iraq. It was not an approval for the war.
Lots of people saying what the real situation was. And again, I do not forgive the Congress people or the senators who voted for that resolution. They did it out of cowardice, many of them. They did it because they didn't have the guts to stand up.
I agree with that. But I do want to add one thing, which is that when the administration did finally get its national intelligence estimate, belatedly the one that was rushed through from the period about September 11th through, I think it was like October 10th. They delivered it to Congress the night before the vote. I think it was about 12 hours before the vote. It was a 90-page document that was classified. It had to be read on the premises under, it was under lock and key and a guard, and certainly all Congress members should have read it, but even the ones who read it were unable to talk about it publicly. So all they could talk about was what was disclosed in the 25-page declassified document that they call the white paper, which misrepresented what was even in the national intelligence estimate. So any congressperson who wanted to explain to his or her constituents why he or she was voting against this authorization was completely hamstrung in making any arguments. So that was another part of the deceit.
That's quite true. Let me just add a little footnote there. Senator Graham, who is not that great a politician, forgive me for saying that, he was focused on running for president himself. He knew that this would be a problem, that only five, in the event, only five people from Congress went to the Hall to read the estimate, okay? So he said, we need an unclassified version, okay? Good idea, except you have to make sure that the unclassified version has the same qualifiers in it as the classified version. In the event, the unclassified version dropped off all the adverbs like possibly, all the clauses like according to an untested source. That's how they shortened it, okay? Now, the person responsible for that, his name is Paul Pillar. And he alone, among all these people who participated in this fraud, has apologized. And you can see that in the book that Isakoff and David Korn wrote, where Pillar says in a very poignant way, I regret that very, very much. I was given the task doing that. I supervised it and let it go. And I wish I had said, no, Mr. President, I will not do that. This is deceitful. I will not deceive the Congress this way. But he went along, like so many others, but to his great credit, he's come clean and said he wished he hadn't done that.
Okay, I'm trying to keep us on time. We have about 50 more questions, but we're not going to ask them all. But two more questions. If impeachment is to move forward, it's very obvious that members of the Republican Party are going to have to vote in favor of moving forward with this process. What would you say to members of the Republican Congress, Republican members of the Congress, about this issue to convince them to your point of view?
I have one quick answer for that. Hillary Clinton. Just keep thinking. Do you want Hillary Clinton to do the same things Bush does? She will.
Well, I would say something else also. Yesterday, I don't know why, but for some reason, my husband and I listened to Barbara Jordan's speech, where she introduced the Articles of Impeachment in 1972. And what she said, we all know this, it's not a partisan issue. If these offenses, and this is pretty much what she said about Nixon, but if these offenses, torture, rendition, and by the way, people in Europe know that these things are wrong. In Germany and Italy and Spain, they know that these are wrong. And signing statements and illegal spying and lying about the war, and that's not even all of it. If these are not impeachable offenses, and this is paraphrasing Barbara Jordan, and I do apologize for that, but she said, then we might as well throw the 18th century Constitution into what is now the 21st century paper shredder, because it's of no use anymore. That's what I would say.
What would you say?
Okay.
Last question for each of you. Please share with us what you think the next step is. What do we do now?
Well, everybody always asks this question, and it's the hardest one. But I guess I would rely on what Molly Ivan said before she passed away, which is If you think this war is wrong, if you think what this administration is doing, do something every day to try to stop it. And no one can tell any other person exactly what that is, but we know there are so many options, and all of you sitting in this room have your tasks cut out for you. You have the support for this resolution that has already been introduced. But go out and talk to people, people who don't already agree with you. That's actually the hardest thing to do, especially people whom you like and you know. It's the hardest thing to do. But write letters to your congresspeople. Do anything you can think of to get your voice heard. Again, it's the power of one voice. And here, I think we have about 500 voices, which gets to be a lot more powerful.
You know, if everybody who sent jokes on the internet sent information about impeachment around, we have a movement. I think really that, you know, just to add to that, I think, first of all, that number one thing for you people to do is your state is actually in a position to do something. You've got a gutsy state senator who's put something out there, and you can really push that. And the way to do it is you all must know 50 people that that you know well enough to argue with and cajole and get behind this. So take the time to do it at work, at home, in your neighborhood, in the supermarket line. Wear an impeachment button. We make people ask about it. Put some on your car. Get a conversation going. And push this thing. And get people out of that rally. Get it past through the hearing. Get it through your legislature. Push it on your congressman. And really, let's make this state a pioneer in this thing and move it. But then, you know, then you're going to have to push people in Congress. It's not going to stop there. This is going to be we need a movement, and a movement doesn't start to stop in a week. So it's going to be a building thing. We need I think I said at the start, and I'll say it again, we need a tidal wave for impeachment, pushing Congress to act and do its and live up to their oaths.
I would suggest that there are a lot of very good models out there, really good models. There's Aaron Matata standing back there. There are parties up there. But you know what, folks? I've learned in the last 4 years that most of the real courageous models are women. Southern Center for Political Studies, whatever it was called, in Atlanta, and I had my four-minute debate with Donald Rumsfeld. I was sitting there wondering whether I would do that, and I had the goods on him, I knew that. But, you know, I said, you know, should I really do that? And then I thought, you know, Cindy Sheehan wouldn't hesitate a second, she'd be right up there. Anne Wright wouldn't hesitate a second, she'd be right up there. Zia Benjamin, the women from the Paul Rose Pink, the Raging Grannies, they'd be right up there. Where the hell are the Raging Grandpas? That's what I want to know. Where are we? So I just suggest that we take our lessons from courage that has already been displayed. It's high time for all of us to get into the act. And if anyone wants to join me in forming the Raging Grandpas, we see you.
I've been asked to point out the postcards that are in your programs. Cool picture on one side. You're asked to fill these out. There are boxes in the lobby where you can drop them. So the organizers have asked to please fill these out. I'd like to welcome back to the podium for a couple of minutes, Linda Boyd.
Okay. Before I talk about what you can do, I want to answer the question, why should Washington State legislate